This episode of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine was made possible by contributions from slaves like you. Spanky very much.
Direct action happens because there is a need for it. Direct action happens because people are fighting back, and we're not waiting for millions of people to stand beside us for the revolution to happen.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, where we smash reality with newspaper boxes. I'm your host, Stimulator, and yeah, I know y'all are sick of the Olympic news, but let us jump straight to the birthplace of the five cock rings of death, Greece. The motherfucking resistance has been fighting the ruling class because those greedy anal drippers want the poor to pay for the mess that they created. The parliament building was stormed by brave freedom fighters because the government passed a new plan that will freeze pensions and raise taxes on the people. A general strike has paralyzed the country, and the resistance has led a relentless attack upon the keepers of the state.
These measures were going to be implemented by the government and the European Union anyway, and they are loading them on us now with the excuse of the crisis. The crisis has been created by the plutocrats, and they should pay for it.
The Greeks are masters at breaking the illusion of police authority, as illustrated by these skilled flag warriors. A similar budgetary crisis has been wreaking havoc on the state of California, where the governor and the rest of the imbeciles that run the state have been slashing funds to public education. As we reported on this show, a statewide day of action was called on by students to show the motherfuckers that if they don't know how to run California's universities, that the motherfucking resistance will occupy, well, everything. In Berkeley, students blocked the gates of the UCB, shutting down the university for that day. Later, they rallied and marched to downtown Oakland, where hundreds of K-12 students walked out and protested on Telegraph Avenue. After the rally, about 200 peeps blocked Highway I-880, only to be brutalized by the motherfucking pigs. Video ninja and submedia contributor Brandon Jordan was arrested for documenting this beatdown. In Frisco, thousands from schools across the city marched and rallied at the Civic Center. In Santa Cruz, students, faculty, and workers gathered at 5 a.m. to shut down UC Santa Cruz by blocking the two main gates. This was followed by rallies and a general assembly.
Student! Student! Student!
In Monterrey, CSU Monterrey students protested the destruction of the higher education system while the state continues to fund prisons. In UC Davis, the motherfucking police beat the fuck out of some students as the resistance attempted to block Interstate 80. And in Sacramento, thousands rallied in front of the Capitol building, protest the scum-sucking politicians and that piece of shit of an actor who rules the world's eighth largest economy. Occupations and solidarity actions also took place in New York, Brooklyn, Hunter College, Milwaukee, and University of Oklahoma, to name a few. In Indonesia, the motherfucking resistance fought the pigs as they expressed their discontent with the shady bailout of a bank. The students attacked the Indo swine with sticks and stones and made the motherfuckers back the fuck down. Yep, as capitalism collapses all around us, the motherfuckers defenders of the rich, i.e. the pig police, and the courts, desperately collaborated to put down any type of rebellion. When members of the motherfucking resistance are put in government cages, it's up to us to provide them with moral support. Recently, Austrians took to the street to show solidarity for several animal rights activists who face up to 5 years in prison due to a new draconian law that criminalizes leftist and animal rights groups. Yep, this is what jail support should look like. And speaking of jail, in Vancouver, now that the Olympics are over, the motherfucking pigs are looking for excuses to jail Olympic resistors. Our guest on today's show, Harsh Ahluwalia, was arrested along with three others for mischief. When I asked her to comment on her arrest, she responded,
"This is bullshit. They picked us up. They knew our names."
Yeah, yeah. All right, all right. of a state and a smile that went along with that.
Get trusted.
Get trusted.
As the smoke dissipated from the smashing success of the Olympic resistance in Vancouver, the view of who's who on what side of the fight became increasingly clear. You break a few windows and liberals masquerading as radicals start showing their ass.
I think the debate on respect for diversity of tactics is sort of long overdue, but in a way it's also happened many times before in many movements in the past. So before coming here to...
That funny-looking chinstrapper right there is Derek O'Keefe. Yep, his voice was cracking because that shot was taken minutes before he got his mind whooped by this woman right here.
I have to admit, in terms of this debate, I know it's been going on for a week, but I've only just read all the Facebook messages and all the emails that are floating around this morning as I was trying to prepare my thoughts. So I'm really frustrated and really angry, to be quite honest.
That was Harsha Wali of the Olympic Resistance Network. Thing is that after the motherfucking resistance successfully disrupted the first day of
the five cock rings of death,
Mr. O'Keefe started running his mouth about things he knows nothing about. This is why I take great personal pleasure in giving you some highlights of a debate on the topic of
the notion of respect for diversity of tactics, and I just want to admit right up front that it's not necessarily the sort of, I think that term and that those ideas come out of a movement or a particular part of the left movement in Canada that is not really the tradition that I became politicized around. I'm not presenting that we have to abandon the notion of respect for diversity of tactics. I think that it's just that it has risks becoming a shibboleth.
Shibboleth?
Shibboleth.
Shibboleth. Wait a motherfucking minute. Shiatsu, shibboleth.
Shibboleth.
There it is. Shibboleth.
Shibboleth.
Used as a test of nationality by its difficult pronunciation.
Well, if I were to guess, I would say O'Keefe is a citizen of the Douche Drizzle Kingdom. But enough talking.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's get ready to rumble!
On his first point, O'Keefe tries to defend his public denunciation of Black Bloc tactics used in Vancouver on Feb 13.
It, not necessarily in theory, but in practice, it can repress open and wide-ranging discussion, both before an action is taken and afterwards in assessing its effectiveness.
If people have criticisms about the 13th, then let's talk about specific criticisms. But all that we have seen is a general denunciation of property destruction. And as far as I'm concerned, every tactic is immune to criticism. That includes if we're going to have mass rallies where politicians are given a free stage to speak, despite their daily obscenities and the daily violence that politicians in this government are responsible for. We can talk about the fact that, you know, symbolic rallies once a year are equally ineffective. So if we're going to talk about ineffectiveness, we need to be able to have the same starting point for every single tactic.
These so-called anything can happen type events or actions preclude or in fact endanger participants from marginalized communities, including the most vulnerable communities that I think naturally our work should be trying to draw in and create safe spaces for their participation.
As a woman of color with a myriad of precarious systemic barriers, including legal status and health, and I can only speak for myself, but I can say that the Black Bloc tactic does not in itself oppress me or render me more vulnerable in protest. So I'd appreciate it if other white men do not make such pronouncements on my behalf or decide what will keep me safe. And perhaps instead they can focus on their own organizational and personal patterns of dominance and privilege.
Oh, snack.
I think any tactic that is used where you have a whole group of people marching in anonymity and a form of presenting yourself to the public that is anonymous risks police infiltration in a serious way and therefore should be seriously questioned.
The fact that people are anonymous is not simply unique to the Black Bloc. As we know, people don masks around the world, probably the most romanticized of which is the Zapatistas. You know, and if we are going to be able to have solidarity with global struggles, we have to understand that the reasons for wearing a mask are the same, whether it's in Chiapas in Palestine or it's the black bloc on our streets. State surveillance and state policing, particularly in the context of the Olympics, where people have had visits by the Vancouver Integrated Security Unit, means that people need to protect themselves. To me, the Black Bloc is not anonymous. It's a tactic, and the members of the Black Bloc are people that are known to me. If people want to come down to Tent Village, you'll probably meet many of them.
After the debate was over, Harsha headed back to said Tent City, an encampment that sprung up on a parking lot rented by Vanak, the organizers of the Five Cockrings of Death. This temporary autonomous zone of homeless people and activists took place right smack in the middle of Canada's poorest neighborhood. I caught up with Harsha to ask her what the f*** was that all about. Hey Harsha, how the f*** are you?
Good, how are you?
Me? F***ing tired.
Me too, I'm f***ing tired.
I think I'm gonna take a little power nap, okay? Well, maybe not. Okay, so why a Tent City?
Tent City was a occupation of 58 West Hastings, which is a lot owned by Concord Pacific, which is Canada's largest and most notorious real estate developer. Over the past 3 years, since 2008, they've been looking to develop a condo site with 130 condo units right in the middle of the downtown east side, which is Canada's poorest neighborhood, poorest postal code in all of Canada. In the kind of lead up to the Olympics, but obviously predating that, we've seen an increasing amount of gentrification, homelessness, and criminalization of the poor. And Concord Pacific, in the past, just prior to the Olympics, leased that land to Vanak for a parking lot. So there was a decision to have a tent city, to have a squat, to occupy an empty lot, basically. It sat empty for the past 2 years in order to make visible both the crisis of homelessness in the context of the Olympics and also to take direct action against gentrification in the downtown east side.
Is the tent city illegal?
It's outside the law, but it's moral.
So why do something illegal rather than asking nicely?
Well, I think the short of it in the context of the downtown east side is it's that it's a community that has had to defend itself against gentrification and criminalization. And those are all processes that have been supported by the law. And so the resistance needs to be outside of the law.
What are some tangible victories of the Tent City?
In the context of the Olympics, where we have, you know, the mayor and the provincial government opening up emergency shelters to kind of make invisible the growing number of homeless in Vancouver, the Tent City made very visible. It's a stark and constant reminder of the $7 billion that went to the Olympics in the context of growing poverty and gentrification and homelessness. It really kind of challenged the state in the context of the Olympics and the party about what acceptable protest is. And I think it really forced the state to contemplate whether it would shut down a homeless tent city just for a fucking parking lot, right? And really kind of forced an eruption around issues of legality and illegality, issues around, you know, the fact that a tent city, which is illegal, was actually a sanctuary in the downtown east side. You know, hundreds of people came to it because it was a cop-free zone, and it really forces a contestation of the idea of what provides safety in this neighborhood.
I gave a talk in Oregon a couple years ago, and this guy afterwards said, you know, you talk a lot about this culture being based on violence, but I don't see it. You know, I'm not violent. And I said, okay, first off, where's your shirt made? And he looked and it was made in Bangladesh. It's like, look, do we even need to talk about that? Second, I said, okay, do you pay rent? He's like, yeah. And I said, why? And he said, because I don't own. And I said, no, what would happen if you didn't pay rent? He said, well, the sheriff would come and evict me. I said, I don't know what that means. What would happen? He said, well, the sheriff would come and he would knock on the door. I said, okay, great. What happens if you open the door and you say, hey, I'm just finishing up making dinner. You want some? And so the sheriff sits down, you feed him, you don't poison him. And then after dinner, you say, well, you know, you've been somewhat pleasant company, but not all that pleasant, so I would like for you to leave my home now. What would happen? He said, well, the sheriff would pull out his gun and he'd say, I'm here to evict you because you didn't pay rent. I said, ah, so the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun is gonna come and take you away.
He said, I think I get it. I said, let's try again.
What happens if you're hungry? So you go to the grocery store and you start eating. What's gonna happen? So we're gonna call the sheriff. I said, yeah, it's the same guy who's gonna come with a gun and take you away. He's a real asshole, isn't he? So one of the reasons we don't see a lot of the violence is because it's exported. And another reason we don't see a lot of the violence is because we've been so metabolized into the system that we bought into this strange notion that it's okay to have to pay to exist on the planet. That's really, really weird. And if you don't pay, then some guy with a gun is gonna come and bad things are gonna happen to you.
This date has had a particularly strong tradition of resistance in Montreal, where just 2 days ago, 11 police cars were reportedly destroyed by 15 to 20 masked people. The slogans ACAB, which stands for All Cops Are Bastards, and FTP, which stands for F*** the Police and Free the Prisoners, were spray painted on walls nearby.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, where dangerous ideas are dispensed without a prescription. I'm your host, The Stimulator, and the fight to stop mountaintop mining to produce so-called
clean coal technologies
brought the motherfucking resistance to Washington, D.C., where two fearless mountain defenders erected massive tripods in front of the Environmental Destructive Agency. The tripod dwellers want EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson to enforce the Clean Water Act and stop mountaintop removal coal mining. Here's tripod dweller and Rainforest Action Network activist Adrian Wilson.
I'm sitting on top of a 20-foot tripod in front of the EPA's DC headquarters, and I'm here today to ask EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson to visit Appalachia and to see for herself the destruction that's being caused by mountaintop removal coal mining.
In Copenhagen, members of the motherfucking resistance who were pre-arrested for alleged future crimes during the COP15 climate clusterfuck got their first day in court. Noah Wise was one of those pre-arrested and explains how police repression didn't stop with climate activists.
Really, what we're seeing here is intense police repression from the Danish state, and it started with kind of a so-called climate activists, and it's been moving to anti-fascist activists. We've had recently 3 arrests of anti-fascist activists who are also facing terror charges. So we're seeing that once the police start this intense campaign of repression, it doesn't stay within one given movement. It quickly moves to other movements. So we really need to have cross-movement solidarity on this stuff.
In Vancouver, where police repression of poor people and activists is a daily reality, the motherfucking resistance took to the streets in an unpermitted march to tell the VPD and the RCM pigs that they are not welcome in our hoods.
We need to stop the false dichotomy of good cop and bad cop. There are no good cops!
The pigs don't really like it when you protest against them, and that's why they bring video cameras to our demos, to identify and intimidate members of the motherfucking resistance. But who can play at that game?
Taping? What is the purpose of you taping?
To film the crowd.
Why are you, what does that serve? What purpose does that serve the police?
It films the crowd. It just gets an idea for everybody that wasn't here what was going on.
It's no surprise that some of these fucks ain't that smart. Just take a look at these undercover pork choppers in Montreal on the very same day. Like in Vancouver, the yearly anti-police march results in confrontations with the popo. During this year's demo, members of the motherfucking Quebecois resistance were able to identify and literally kick out a number of undercover pigs from the demo. And on the subject of retaliation against the Poe, the trial of Christopher Munford started in Seattle. Munford is accused of killing one cop and injuring another, as well as firebombing 4 pigmobiles last October in retaliation for the brutal beating of Malika Calhoun. On his first day in court, Munford launched into what the bootlicking corporate media called a rambling soliloquy. I think of it more as a lucid analysis on why we must fight back.
This world has seen that kind of behavior before. We saw it in World War II with Stalin, as he took power away from the people and abused his police authorities. We saw it with Mussolini, and we saw it with Hitler. This is not a small problem. We have forgotten that the very first war that our people have fought was against a police force. It was not answerable to the people. The police force was a local police force. It was answerable to King George III.
The tradition of pine is as old as the Three Stooges, maybe even older.
As a rule, parties bore me, but I know I'm going to get a big bang out of this one.
Oh, Senator, I'm so sorry.
Pieing is a harmless and delicious way to humiliate movement traitors, capitalist scumbags like Bill Gates, or homophobic evangelical freaks like Anita Bryant. The deal is that no one gets hurt while causing many laughs. But when you attack somebody from the fucking resistance with a pie laced with hot chili peppers, well, then you are just acting like the motherfucking police. This is what happened to writer and activist Lear Keith. Three mass pie perpetrators delivered the spicy treats during a lecture by Lear during the San Francisco Anarchist Book Fair. The execution of the pie is commendable, but the target was, in my opinion, a mistake. Apparently, the spicy pie gang are vegan activists who have beef with Lear, who was a vegan for 20 years, because she wrote a book called The Vegetarian Myth. I, for one, support people's right to eat whatever the f*** they want. I've been a vegan and a vegetarian in the past, and I agree that the evil practice of factory meat production is something that must be stopped at all costs. But Jesus f***ing Christ, sometimes hardcore vegan activists are worse than f***ing evangelical Bible beaters. Y'all need to chill the f*** out and look at who your real enemies are. Lear is not one of them. If you stop and listen to Lear's arguments for a motherfucking minute, you'll learn that what she's really talking about is topsoil. But I'll shut the fuck up and let Lear speak for herself. I caught up with her last December at the Humble Anarchist Book Fair. Hey Lear, how the fuck are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm trying to relax after that rather hostile crowd.
So, the vegetarian myth, what's the big fucking deal?
Agriculture is actually the most destructive thing that people have done to the planet, so more of the same is not going to save us. Agriculture has run through every continent. There are none left. That means we've destroyed all the topsoil. We've also destroyed the prairies, the forests, the wetlands, the rivers, in order to grow a monocrop of humans. So all of that life has been funneled into simply increasing numbers of the human population. This will never be sustainable. There is no topsoil left. At this point, what we're eating is fossil fuel. And obviously, that's not going to last forever either. And in order to repair this planet, we've got to bring back those forests and prairies and wetlands. If we simply got out of the way, it would happen on its own. We could certainly participate and make it happen faster. But ultimately, we need to take our sustenance as a species from inside those living communities. We can't continue to impose ourselves across the world and expect there to be any life left at the end.
How does industrial agriculture destroy topsoil?
You have to understand what agriculture is. You take a piece of land and you clear every living thing off it. And I mean down to the bacteria. And then you plant it to human use. In order to grow the annual monocrops that agriculture is founded on, that civilization is founded on, you have to clear the land because those annual seeds, they're really big seed heads, they cannot compete against perennial grasses or forests. So the forest has to come down or the prairie has to be plowed up. Once the land is cleared, once the soil is bare, you can then plant those seeds. But this is an inherently destructive process. I mean, first of all, you're destroying entire ecosystems. And second of all, by clearing that soil, you're destroying it. It's just like us. So when soil is exposed, it dies. The sun bakes it and the rain compounds it, and then the wind will just blow it away.
I once heard that cow farts are one of the biggest sources of CO2 gases, and that quitting meat is one of the best things a person can do to save their motherfucking planet. Is that bullshit?
Yeah, this really goes back to the fact that they're feeding corn to ruminants. That's not their native diet. If you let them eat cellulose, which is what they prefer, it's the diet they evolved eating was grass, the methane problem is tremendously reduced. It's because they're being fed the wrong food. That's why they're producing so much methane. And a lot of those statistics are really overblown anyway. I mean, it may be as little as 3%, in fact, of the methane is actually from cows. So I think a lot of that is just people with a political agenda sort of taking it and running with it.
Thanks, Lear. And that about does it for this edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine. The following peeps share their piece of their pie in order to make the real. Dan, Noah, Sebastian, Samuel, Birgit, Steve, Anderson, Flip, Garson, Nathan, Andrew, Margaret, Sebastian, Christian, Martin, Will, and Bird. Pipe Lotion. To comment on this show, or for links to Lear Keith, just visit my website, stimulator.tv. Now, shut your pie hole.
Remember, kids, you can podcast high-quality video of this show at submedia.tv.